Cochise Talk.
Welcome back to Doing Lunch with Dan Abrams. That's me. We're live at the Golden Corral Restaurant on Highway 92 in always beautiful Sierra Vista, Arizona. My guest today is Bill Buppert. Bill is a former soldier and a current military contractor who's an observer and commentator on politics and economics in the world. He writes essays on LouRockwell.com, and if you look at his work, you'll see that he expresses some pretty radical ideas. I'd love to hear radical ideas. Actually, I like to hear ideas from across the spectrum of thought. Rarely do I hear something that stops me in my tracks and leaves me speechless, but Bill has done that to me this week. I have invited him to share some of his thinking with us today. Welcome to Doing Lunch.
Hey, Dan. How are you?
Doing great. Let's go right to the meat of the matter here.
Okay.
How do you see the State of the Union today in America?
I think that we have gone over a cliff economically and to a certain extent socially, and that 10 years hence, America is not going to look like the map that we see in our geography books today.
Really? What do you see it looking like?
I see it dividing into a number of nation states within what is now called the United States of America. Could be 2, could be 9, could be 18. Lord knows how many that it would be. But I see it. I see a divisibility and a number of secessions and upheavals, both violent and peaceful, occurring over the next 10 years.
What would cause that sense of secession in states?
Well, it was interesting. While I was listening to your conversation with the sheriff, if I may bring that into account as an example, what I think that they miss in the drug war debate are two factors. Number one, it is a war against people's right to alter their own consciousness. And number two, it's a state rights issue. The federal government should have nothing whatsoever to do with it. But as you're well aware, probably since Wilson's time during World War I, and we could even go back to that beast named Lincoln during the War of Northern Aggression, we can discover...
You must be a Southerner by birth.
Well, remember, the Confederacy isn't a region, it's a state of mind.
Okay.
So I think that the states' rights issue, the economic mismanagement that we've seen for, I would say, well over a century, but certainly the 20th century gave a whole lot of economic mismanagement at the federal government level, evident for all to see.
Okay. So that's what would cause a state to secede from the Union, is economic mismanagement.
I think that that would be one of the factors. For instance, before D.C. versus Heller, which was the handgun argument that went before the Supreme Court for the first time since 1939, they were debating whether D.C. could cause its citizens in D.C., which is not a state, but a district, as it were, that would not be a state and not have voting rights. They were trying to see if they could ban handgun possession in that case specifically, but arms ownership overall, if they could do that. Well, Montana and several other states came out and said, you know, if you guys declare that we no longer have the individual right to own firearms, then what we may do is leave this union because you've broken the contract. We now have state sovereignty movements in over 13 states to include Alaska and Montana. There's whisperings of it in Idaho. Even here in the state of Arizona, there was one put forward in 2000 where they said that if you violate state's sovereignty and the 10th Amendment and whatever other list of, I guess, what you could call it is, depredations against the states by the federal government, we're going to leave the contract because you've broken it.
How many people agree with that sentiment in those states? So there's an awful lot of people out there that wave the American flag very proudly.
Yes.
And Texas is one of those states that has a big secessionist movement going on.
It does. Larry Kilgore ran for governor on that platform.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
And there's an awful lot of flag-waving Texans there. What do you suppose happens to all of them when the secessionist movement rises up?
I don't know, because remember, we were birthed in secession as a country. If we weren't birthed in secession as a country, we'd still be English subjects as we speak. But we decided that George III, we'd be better off without him. And then there was a second attempt, what one could call the Second American Revolution, in 1860, in which we said, nah, maybe we don't like what's going on now, and we're going to go our own way.
Not particularly successfully, though.
It was not.
And do you see that there's a potential for this movement in the United States? I mean, you're saying that in 10 years you could see that the United States could spin off countries, the Soviet Union, after the fall of the Soviet Union, the Iron Curtain falling in 1989, spun off about 15 separate countries, with some of them doing better than others, and some of them constantly at war. Georgia, for instance, constantly at war with their former masters. Do you see that as being the state of our union 10 years from now?
Well, let's go to first principles, though, and remember that the reason why Russia went into Georgia is because of what Georgia was doing in South Ossetia, which was trying to secede from Georgia proper.
Essentially what Georgia was trying to do from the Soviet Union for between World War II and 1989.
Yeah. You know, as I've discussed in my essay, divorce isn't a bad thing at the individual level, and one could suppose as a result of our own burgeoning nation that we created in 1776... that there are times when you say either the government is too large, the government is too monstrous, the government is too tyrannical, or it simply can't manage its affairs well enough to suit the people under whom they are ruled.
Are you pessimistic about the future, optimistic about the future, or just waiting to see?
I'm waiting to see, but I would say I'm pessimistic because we are facing an economic apocalypse from which we cannot shrink. There is virtually nothing that the U.S. government could do to stop our economic collapse.
And how did we get here, in your opinion?
Well, in 1913, without taking lap swims in the conspiratorial fever swamp, we had the Federal Reserve Act, which essentially said that there is only one organization that is chartered by the United States government to coin currency and tell us, less a gold standard, what the value of that currency would be. I think that with, I like to call them Red DR instead of FDR, what the FDR policies were in the 1930s and 40s were very much socialist programs. As a matter of fact, from 1932 to 1938, unemployment rate went up 1.5 points to 19.5 to 20.5%, despite tens of billions of dollars invested in government programs and the government taking over vast swaths of the economy.
Okay. So. And how does that correspond to today?
Well, we look at
about vast social programs and the amount of money that's spending on them. Yeah. It pales in comparison to the efforts of the U.S. government today.
Oh, absolutely. You know, as a matter of fact, they call this a Great Depression, but I would go back to the Great Panic of 1873, which would be more informative about what's going to happen. But remember, during the Great Depression, Americans had two factors they do not have today. Number one, they were much closer to their food sources. And number two, they were much closer to their families and more self-reliant. Vast manufacturing base at that time, vast agricultural base. People weren't in service industries so much as the exploitation of raw resources and turning those raw resources into products, for the most part. We are not in that position today. The other thing we have to face is that we have 60 to $100 trillion in non-funded, I repeat, non-funded liabilities for Socialist Security, Medicare, the prescription drug bill that the Bushevics gave us. And we've got all of these non-funded liabilities. We've got a $10 trillion plus debt, by the way, $4.6 trillion when George Bush came in. So he has more than doubled it since 1776 when he came in. Obama is talking about a $1.7 trillion deficit on the debt.
That say that without even slowing down, $1.7 trillion.
That's a lot of money, isn't it?
It sure is. You divide that by the number of people in America, and you're going to see some shrinking wallets out there.
Here's something that's going to shock you. International Bank for Settlements talks about derivatives. You've heard of derivatives. It's the buzzword.
I'm quite familiar with
there.
Derivatives, yeah.
What a derivative is basically an investment instrument that is comprised of thousands of IOUs in which there are no counterparty or collateralized obligations for both parties. In other words, you're lending money to lend money to lend money to lend money and taking a bet on that money like you would do in Vegas. The International Bank for Settlements estimates that the total is $1.24 quadrillion.
What is that number? Actually, I had heard $500 trillion was the number.
It's a whole lot of trillions.
It's a whole lot of trillions.
But divide that by 6 billion humans on the face of the earth, you have $190,000 per capita.
Every man, woman, and child.
Yes.
And
yes.
You might want to throw your dog and cat in there, too.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. So what this all comes down to is that we had a subprime crisis in which people were asked, hey, can you pay for this? Well, I've got a no doc. I've got this income. I'm declaring stuff without proving it. I really can't afford a $600,000 house on my $50,000 income, but you're going to give me the house anyhow, to which the banks would nod and say, through both government and corporate mismanagement, yes, we'll do that.
Isn't that a bit cynical on the part of the lenders?
I think it's a bit cynical, but they also knew that with the FDIC, their bets were assured, which has just been increased to $250,000 per capita per bank.
It has. That was about the greed of, as the accelerating value of those houses, as the value kept accelerating, mm-hmm. and I'm not saying that it went up, but the rate of acceleration went up.
Yeah.
They were thinking that it doesn't matter who signs for this. What we want to do is put it in our portfolio. So if we can just find anybody out there that's willing to sign on the bottom line here, then when the loan goes bad, we can take it back, and then we can sell it for more than we paid for it. That's pretty cynical.
It is cynical, but it could be worse than that, which is called collateralizing of the debt, which means that you come to me for a bank loan, and I'm your banker, and I offer you a loan. A week later, I sell that paper as securitized debt to somebody else, which means that I have no responsibility whatsoever for that note, for that mortgage, for that loan from that time forward. So there's no obligation for me to do the right thing, because if that note happens to fail, my bank isn't going to suffer, because I've sent it elsewhere, and I put it in a package, and investors have invested in it.
And you know, back in October, those people, as that chain of those notes started to go down the line, they started to send them back up the other way. And then when it hit the first guy who actually didn't have any money at all he had was a whole lot of promises, it went bad.
Yes. Yeah. And now we're seeing exponential growth of that. But the other shoe hasn't fallen. The derivatives shoe hasn't fallen. And the fact that we may be in a deflationary time right now, but we are guaranteeing ourselves inflationary times by the printing of monies for which we have no backing whatsoever, essentially.
Just the confidence of the American consumer.
And we see that confidence has started to wane, haven't we?
We have seen that. So, in fact, it's at its lowest level since they started recording confidence numbers of the American consumer.
Yeah.
They think anything below 50% is pretty nerve-wracking. I think we're at about 36% right now on the confidence scale, and for the reasons that you're citing. So this derivative situation, the quadrillions now, it was hard for me to say trillion after billion. It was hard for me to say billion after million. Now we're into the quadrillions of derivatives. What happens when they're called? Is that the apocalypse? Is when China says, I'm not giving you any more money because you people are spending it irresponsibly. Is that when it all goes bad?
I think I can't pin down when it all goes bad because I don't have that crystal ball, but I think that's one of the factors, because we have an economic perfect storm here. Because what the U.S. government has done, and I would submit to you other major governments have done, is they've taken the subprime lending model, which is, I don't have the money to pay for something, but I'm going to sign off on it. You and I make $50,000 a year, hypothetically. We're offered $10 million credit cards. And our limit increase after we've spent that is given to us again and again and again. Well, that can only go so far, especially when we saw how far it would go. But that's essentially the subprime crisis that started this in the first place. One of the components of subprime crisis is the very behavior that is being emulated by the government, because what they're doing is they're taking out loans for things with money they don't have to pay for something they can't possibly pay back.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems like that they thought the banks have a great idea. Yeah, let's do what they've been doing. We're going to have to take a break here. If you want to get in on the conversation, you can email me at dan@cocheesetalk.com, and I'll get your questions over to Bill, and he can answer them directly, because I'm not able to answer all of those questions that I'm asking Bill. That's why he's here. You're doing lunch with Dan Abrams live at the Golden Corral Restaurant in Sierra Vista, Arizona, on Cochise Talk at cocheesetalk.com. We're going to take a couple-minute break and be back.
Cochise Talk.
Hi, this is Les from Sierra Vista Ace, your locally owned and operated helpful place. Come in today for great service and a wide selection of the items you need every day. Things like plungers, light bulbs, duct tape, glue, and nails. Yes, even his and hers hammers. We offer advice for your fix-it needs and offer delivery for large items. Save gas, save time, shop Ace first. Sierra Vista Ace since 1981 on the corner of Fry and Highway 92.
Shop at Ace, your local helpful hardware place. When was the last time you told her how much you really love her?
When was the last time you told her how beautiful she is, how soft her skin, and how wonderful she is? Tell her today with a gift from Visage, the Visage European Day Spa, Cochise County's premier full-service day spa. Say it all with a gift from Visage. Call 459-5144. That's 459-5144. Visage.
The deadliest terrorists on the planet don't live in the Middle East.
They have no conscience. They have no pulse.
For the first time in American history, you'll see the story that the media can't tell and the government won't tell. A 30-year war is about to be exposed, and the cartels would kill to keep it from coming out.
We need to get serious about this drug war.
We have to stop it.
Drug Wars. Buy the DVD now at drugwarsthemovie.com.
Cochise Talk.
Welcome back to Doing Lunch with Dan Abrams. We're live at the Golden Corral Restaurant on Highway 92 in always beautiful Sierra Vista, Arizona. Today, my guest is Bill Buepert, and I invited him on the show because his ideas are somewhat different from the mainstream, and he's articulate enough to express them. So I read On Your Mind in the local newspaper a lot, and I got to tell you, there's a lot of people that are not mainstream thinkers that are not particularly effective at expressing their ideas as expressed in Out of Your Mind. I'm sorry, did I say Out of Your Mind? What I meant was On Your Mind in the local Herald. And Bill Buepert, on the other hand, is articulate enough and has thought through some of these ideas. What we want to talk about now is something that he suggested, and that is the coming apocalypse, what it's going to look like, and how you can prepare for it. And what started that was my producer, Chuck Alton, came to me and he said, I met a guy who said that he was ready to leave America. And I said, is he an American? And he said, he is an American. Not only that, but he's a former soldier. He works as a government contractor. He works at Fort Huachuca, Arizona. He derives his income from the United States taxpayer, and he's ready to sell everything and leave. And I said, I got to have him on the show. And here he is. So would you elaborate a little bit on those thoughts for us?
I'll elaborate. And in a previous conversation you and I had, my window for leaving evaporated in 2005, which happened to coincide with the peak of the real estate boondoggle that we had. So,
So you should have got out in 2005?
I think so.
I know some people that share your sentiments there.
Yeah.
They're called Americans.
Yes. Well, that's because we have a 60% tax burden plus on us, and we don't enjoy that very much, giving so much tribute to the king and his minions.
You know, it's not what you pay, it's what you get for what you pay.
My return hasn't been all that great. So.
Hey, welcome to America in the first part of the 21st century.
So I guess one of the questions that you wanted to ask was, so we've gone off a cliff, if you subscribe to that, and I certainly do, and economically we're in the hazard, and we could be seeing Great Depression 2 with far greater troubles than they suffered in the 1930s.
You know, the feeling that I get in general out there is that people are in denial over that, and that if you try to take them down that path, they don't want to go there.
I agree with you, but people should have their eyes wide open now, because I think that all the indicators out there for the economic perfect storm that we talked about, for societal pressures that are starting, I mean, you just had Sheriff Deaver on, and you were talking about this massive influx of immigration. And I got an email the other day that talked about something to the I think you got the same one that talked about one-third of $1 trillion being attributed to the maintenance of illegals, whether that's in our education systems, in our healthcare system, or the one-third who presently reside in our federal penitentiary system and other systems within the states. I mean, that's absolutely unsustainable over the long term. This entire make-believe scheme. I mean, I'm surprised they didn't put Bernie Madoff in charge of the Social Security Administration because of his expertise in Ponzi schemes.
They don't need him. They've got that part already figured out.
They may have
well.
That figured out, yeah. Yes. So I guess the rub of it would be, well, I'm in this fix. I'm going to drink the Kool-Aid. I'm going to take the red pill, and I believe that there is an economic apocalypse imminent. What do I do next?
And describe what that economic apocalypse would look like, though.
I think what it's going to look like is you're going to have vast swaths of the economy put out of work. You're going to see bread and basic commodities either not at the markets or costing a whole lot more than you're used to. I'm being completely hypothetical, but we could be paying $100 for a loaf of bread, given the fact that our currency is being devalued, because that's a formal government instrumentation to devalue a currency. But they're doing it through other ways, by printing so much money that it really means nothing in the end, because it isn't backed up by anything but what you talked about, the confidence of the American people.
Okay.
So what do we do about it?
And so your description is that, say, 25 to 30% of Americans are put out of work.
Yes.
Is that the kind of number you're...
It would be, and that's completely hypothetical because, you know, I can't judge the second and third order effects of what's going to happen in this. So.
And then a freeze on credit.
An absolute freeze on credit.
Okay, and that's inevitable, I think.
You know,
I was talking to an economist recently about that, and he was saying things will never be like they were before. You will never see people being able to just walk to their mailbox and have $5,000 on a little plastic card to go out and do whatever you want to do with. That's gone.
Absolutely. You know, we look at the big three, and the common picture we're painted is the big three has been strangled because they can't compete and because of the unions. Well, there's another reason for that, too. The big three, part of their marketing strategy was subprime loans for people who didn't belong in new vehicles in the first place.
Yep.
And that has dried up. When that dried up in the past 18 months, you'll notice that coincide with them going off a cliff economically.
I did. You know, actually, if you figure out all the money that we're giving to the car companies, they could buy cars for about 20 million people, give them to them, then we could all have a free car, and they would all be back in business again.
That sounds like a grand socialist idea.
Oh, does it? I'm sorry. Was that socialist? You know, maybe I've been listening to the current administration too long, and I'm getting comfortable.
Well, remember, though, that this is simply the successor to the Bush administration with a seamless transition. One's black, one's white, but they're both red.
So it would seem. And again, I'm getting kind of comfortable with the idea that maybe government intervention can be helpful. You're dead set against that.
You believe that
the free market can handle all of this. Yet the free market... is a big component of how we ended up here.
Well, let's remember, though, I disagree with that notion in the first place, that the free market is a big component of why we ended up here, because I think it's government intervention, taxation, and regulation that has caused perverse incentives to be put in place where people behave in perverse ways. For instance, remember, the free market embraces failure. The free market embraces the fact that if you're a buggy whip maker and they stop making buggies, we shouldn't subsidize those buggy whip makers. If you continue to subsidize things, you will always get more of them, even if you don't need them. That's the reason why the Soviet Union could produce 10 million left shoes of a pair and 9 quadruple E, because they didn't have an end user. They had no price signals. They had no idea how to economically, rationally allocate their resources. It's what I tell people about recycling. If recycling were economically effective, they would pay you to do it.
Right.
Yeah.
So how does one prepare for the apocalypse?
We use this term apocalypse. Maybe we can call it something that doesn't make people fill their pants, like the coming depression or the coming recession minus or recession plus, whatever you want to call it.
I don't think that inspires much confidence, Bill.
Let's not
sugarcoat this thing.
My primary admonition would be G3, gold, guns, and groceries. I think that you should put your monies in gold and silver, platinum, palladium, or rhodium, if you wish, but gold and silver. Most likely bullion, not coins, because when it comes to coins, there's a lot of numismatic and blue sky value in those,
right.
Which in a coming economy, how many numismatic coin experts are there going to be out there to say, that $20 that you paid over the bullion price, I can see the value in that because of the finer edges or whatever.
Yeah, the question is, how many coin dealers are going to survive the apocalypse?
How many? So if you have that, it's not a way to get rich, it's a way to hedge against inflation, and that's what gold and silver will give you.
Okay.
What guns will give you, of course, is guns being liberty's teeth and being the method by which you defend yourself. And as we discovered on April 19, 1775 in Lexington and Concord, it's the way you throw the Red King, King George III, off your back and create a new nation. We are a nation founded on guns, and basically the cops won't be there to help you when this happens because it's not their job to protect you as an individual.
So do you see it as every man for himself?
I see it as every community for themselves, not every man for themselves, because no man can be an island.
And the community is like-minded people banding together.
It would
under
be.
A common
yes.
banner.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so the preparedness, you were talking about leaving the country.
Yes.
Where would you go?
Well, what we bandied about was places like Argentina or places in South America, because what I'm really fond of in South America and Latin America is that they're really upfront about their corruption. Whereas if I'm paying a tax, my tax is in this form. A man stops me because I'm going too fast or because I haven't paid this or that. I simply grease his palms and I move on. The corruption we have in this country, we pride ourselves on not being corrupt, but I'm here to tell you we are rife with it. The corruption in this country is that you're doing it for the children. You're doing it for your safety. You're doing it for your neighbor. Well, essentially what taxation is measuring your compassion by the amount of your neighbor's money you take at gunpoint. That's what it comes down to as a first principle. And that is wrong.
So that is wrong. So once again, let's look at the scenario. What happens to all of the people that are not prepared?
Here's an interesting phenomenon. Remember Katrina? New Orleans, can't forget that.
Yep, changed the face of New Orleans forever.
It did. Why we spend the tens of millions of dollars to subsidize a city below sea level, I have no idea. That should be on them to do that themselves.
Yeah, I think that we can probably follow the money on that trail and see where it goes.
Yeah. Exactly. But you look at a number of articles, and you'll find that whether they were police officers, FEMA, government officials, even people in the community, people who were prepared with generators, had extra water and all that stuff, were looked at with suspicion because they had prepared, because they had thought ahead. So their neighbors would look at them and say, how come you're hoarding food, or how come you're doing these things? I think that our society has become so dependent on dependence, whether through the government schools or the government, or maybe people being shaped and influenced by the media. One thing I like to say is that city folk pride themselves on their lack of self-sufficiency. They pride themselves on the fact that they can purchase anything they want, but don't have to have the means, wherewithal, or ability to fabricate things, to build things, to fix things, to make their own food, to find out where their food came from. So preparedness, I would say, is not just a matter of getting ready for any coming economic hiccups or anything like that. You should make it a lifestyle. My wife is a master gardener. We homeschool our children. We participate in a number of hobbies to include rifle events, things like that. So, you know, we try to fold our preparations for the future into what we do on an everyday basis, because as a husband and father, my first and foremost priority and obligation and duty is to protect and take care of my family.
Absolutely.
Because if I don't do that, I have failed.
Yep.
So that's why preparedness, to a certain extent, is a duty and an obligation, I think.
I'm going to calm down the heated rhetoric here for just a moment and go to your event that you're doing this weekend.
So
you mentioned rifle events.
Well, actually, we have something called the Appleseed Program, which is sponsored by the Revolutionary War Veterans Association.
What qualifies you as a Revolutionary War veteran?
Well, I'm not as young as I look. No, but just kidding.
Actually, 262 years old. You do look good for your age. Yeah.
What it is it's a combination of having a rifle clinic for 2 days and teaching the history that founded the nation. So we talk a whole lot about Lexington and Concord and what animated the fight to secede from the mother country in England. And also we teach you how to hit the rifleman's quarter mile, which is 500-meter shots with the rifle of your choice, whether that be a 22 or a centerfire rifle. All women and children and active duty.
You're not going to hit the target with a musket.
Well, you could.
Oh,
because they had 250-meter shooters back then.
Oh, yeah.
They did.
Mm-hmm.
They did. And all women, children, active duty, guards, and reserves are free. Two-day rifle clinic, April 25th and 26th. $70 pre-register for those who don't qualify for the aforementioned categories.
And where does that take place?
Sierra Vista Rifle Range, 13 miles due east of here.
Okay. You can't miss it. There's going to be signs and stuff
there out
there.
There will be lots of signs, yeah.
Okay.
And you'll recognize the guy with the musket who's on the sign.
Ah. And, yeah. and again, this is for people who are members of this Revolutionary War Veterans
No,
Society.
You don't even have to be a member of the RWVA.
Okay.
If you want to come, and if you've never shot a rifle before, come on down.
How
if you don't have a rifle, come on down and we'll lend you one.
And how big is this group?
The group is nationwide. There's something called the Appleseed Project that you can Google, and you can find that. And I'm one of the new instructors here in the state of Arizona, but there's only three of us in the state of Arizona. But it's been around for almost 5 years, and basically what our goal is to create a nation of riflemen, because as a rifleman, that can become your politics.
It certainly can.
Yes.
Yep, and it gets your point across very quickly, too. There's not a lot of debate.
It does. It's all a matter of feet per second.
So how did you end up being the kind of person you are? I got 1 minute for you to answer that question until we have to go off the air. Are you an angry person, would you say, or are you just analytical and have come to these conclusions?
I'm more an analytical person, but I'm a passionate person because I don't like being robbed of my individuality. I don't like being robbed of my sovereignty. and I don't like the ability of people to have their way over me without me having any recompense whatsoever.
Yet you are still a member of our society.
Yes.
You still are a contributing member of America. So you see some good in it. I mean, there's some value to being in America.
I absolutely do, but all the good that I see in America emanates from individuals and people and not the government we've created. Because my oath, whether I was in uniform or out of uniform, was always to the Constitution, to enemies foreign and domestic.
And those domestic enemies take a lot of forms, don't
they?
Well,
wouldn't it be interesting? We could discuss a program on treason now, couldn't we?
And
who the traitor is.
I suppose we could, and we're going to have to save it for another program, which I can guarantee my listeners we will have, because I'm very interested in going down that road with you. You can email me or Bill at dan@cocheesetalk.com. You've been listening to us on the World Wide Web at cocheesetalk.com. And I'd like to once again thank Bill Buport for coming and sharing his ideas with us. I am looking forward to many, many more of them.
Thank you. Thank you.
Doing the Cochise Talk.